Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jeremy Scahill, an investigative reporter, war correspondent, and co-founder of The Intercept, a new digital magazine published by First Look Media. He is the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, which was recently made into the film Dirty Wars, now up for the Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. He has an article with Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, the NSA secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Scahill.
It's good to be with you.
And let's start with your new project. Is The Intercept a part of the new project that you're doing with Glenn Greenwald?
Yes. I mean, what Glenn and Laura Poitras, a great filmmaker, and myself had been discussing for some time creating our own news organization. It's not that we weren't happy working at places like The Guardian or The Nation magazine, but we wanted a place where we could have a more streamlined process to get news stories out and to work with primary documents from whistleblowers like Edward Snowden. So this is the first imprint of what is going to be a much larger media project.
And this is the one that the eBay billionaire in Hawaii.
If you had told me, you know, like 15 years ago when I first walked into KPFK that I would be working, you know, with the founder of eBay, I would have asked for some of the crack you're smoking. No, but look, it's interesting. All of us, and we know this here at Pacifica, are trying to find ways to fund and sustain investigative journalism. And Pierre Omidyar is the man we're talking about. Really shared a vision that Glenn and Laura and I had about building an adversarial media outlet. And so our interests collided and or merged together. And so, yeah, we're working on this project together. It's a strange affair. You know, I mean, I would have never imagined that I'd be working with Pierre Omidyar, but it's been great to work with him. And he's really encouraged us to build the kind of media outlet we want.
Well, your film, Dirty Wars, which is up for the Academy Award, to some extent, this is not its main focus, but you can't help seeing the dichotomy in the press between what Hazel Menken, I think it was, it said, you know, that the job of the press is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And it seems like that in many ways that the tables have reversed. And so much of when you appeared on the mainstream media, it was adversarial, mm-hmm. and that you're an outlier. So why not build from that point of view?
Well, I mean, you know what's interesting about that? I'm a very fast talker, and part of it is because I went to the Amy Goodman School of Journalism, but part of it is because when I'm invited onto those shows, if I end up on MSNBC or CNN or HBO on Bill Maher's show, I always assume it's the last time I'm going to be let on. So I try to get in as many points that I think represent a much broader swath of society that are often represented in the corporate media.
Well, I want to talk more about the film, obviously, because we're offering it up here in support of Background Briefing and KPFK in our fund drive. But just to touch on this, a surreal moment we have now, which of course is very close to the film in the sense that history is repeating itself. Now, apparently, the White House and the Justice Department are having some sort of soul-searching, perhaps, or at least conversations about whether or not to kill an American or how to build the legal justification to do so. And it leads you with this surreal conclusion that the advantage of being an American citizen is that they actually have a conversation before they kill you as opposed to just zapping you.
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, in our film, we tell the story of this American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an imam in Washington, D.C., was a U.S. citizen who was born in New Mexico, and ended up becoming the target of President Obama's pursuit to kill him in a drone strike. And eventually he was killed in September of 2011. 2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son was killed. The kid had nothing to do with terrorism, hadn't seen his father in years. And it took the Obama administration a full year after those strikes to actually admit that it was, in fact, the U.S. that killed its own citizens. And Obama has admitted to drone striking four American citizens. But Ian, the story that you're referring to now came out recently in the press that they apparently are debating whether or not to kill another U.S. citizen. And my understanding is that the country in question is Pakistan, that there's an American there. To me, this indicates that they've already made the decision to do it. And they're sort of floating a bubble to try to see American reaction to it. But this administration under President Obama has assumed emperor-like powers over Americans and non-Americans alike. It's like the scene from Alice in Wonderland, where the queen says, you know, verdict first, trial later, or sentence first, trial later. And, you know, we have the president who won the Nobel Peace Prize effectively serving as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. And I don't think American lives are worth a penny more than non-American lives. But what's important here is that if they're willing to go this far to kill their own citizens, it's a good indicator of how they view the rights of others around the world. But you're right. At least it seems as though if you're an American, there's at least a discussion in secret about whether or not to execute you.
A peculiar form of American exceptionalism.
Right. Well, but I mean, in other nations around the world are certainly in bed with the United States. But what's interesting is that Obama, because of who he is, has used his moral, political capital or credibility to try to say not only that the U.S. has a right to do this, but is right in doing it.
Again, Jeremy Scahill has joined me in the studio. He's an investigative reporter, war correspondent, and co-founder of The Intercept, a new digital magazine published by First Look Media. He's the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, which was recently made into the film Dirty Wars, now up for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. He has an article with Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. And you've got obviously an incredible source here, this U.S. Air Force drone operator, Brandon Bryant. And he is having, a dark night of the soul, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, we have two new sources in this piece. Brandon, whose name we've used publicly, and he agreed to that. But then we have another source who worked for both the NSA and the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, this elite military unit. And both of these men were a part of scores of kills in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, elsewhere. And they came to a point where they felt that they were a part of operations that were indiscriminately killing civilians in pursuit of a relatively small number of potential terrorists or suspected militants is the term du jour. And that's part of the reason why they spoke to us for this story.
But one of the things that really got my attention in your film, Dirty Wars, was the special operations warrior who basically said, that we have developed the world's most lethal and sophisticated hammer. Yeah. And for the next several decades, we're going to be running around the world looking for nails. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of also the metaphor for the war on terror, too. And the film makes that really clear, that in many ways we create our own nemesis. I mean, arguably George W. Bush was a gift that kept on giving as far as bin Laden was concerned. He did all of the things that bin Laden said that justified 9/11, Christian armies on Islamic soils, grabbing our oil, destroying our culture, our cities, and murdering our people. And you actually have a clip in there of George Bush's use of the word crusade. Mm. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary. And the film, The Dirty Wars, indicates that on a smaller scale, that's what JSOC is doing as mm-hmm. well. So how do you break this cycle?
Right. I mean, it really has become a self-fulfilling prophecy that the U.S. invades Iraq in 2003 after a merciless campaign of economic sanctions that stretched on for a couple of decades, regular bombings under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones. I know you covered that extensively at the time, as did I. But then you have Bush and Cheney decide to actually invade Iraq, a country where the only al-Qaeda presence was in the north of the country where Saddam Hussein was not in control, in the Kurdish sections of northern Iraq. And that was the only AQ presence in the country. Now you actually have al-Qaeda-linked organizations seizing territory in Iraq, seizing territory in Yemen, seizing territory in Somalia. All of this can be traced back to the launch of this sort of borderless global war. And President Obama, I mean, to call it a war, though, is a bit inaccurate when you have the most powerful military in the world going up against people who have little capacity other than to blow themselves up or to occasionally try to take down an airliner. And the U.S., is a major nuclear power with infinite military resources and corporations servicing its wars. But now under President Obama, you have a guy who comes into office and he has limited foreign policy experience, no military experience, and he's briefed by the generals, the admirals, the CIA, all of the intelligence agencies, and they paint a picture for him of a world where there are thousands of concurrent threats against the U.S. And that the so-called homeland will be struck if we don't take the fight to the terrorists. Obama's political advisors are listening in on those briefings, and they foresee a one-term presidency if there's an attack on U.S. soil. And so President Obama didn't just enlist JSOC and the CIA's paramilitary division to implement a policy. He made them the policy itself. And so you have this mentality that the U.S. can kill its way to victory. And I really think that we've hit a point and I don't say this rhetorically. I say it because I've spent time on the ground in these places where the U.S. is making more new enemies for itself than it is killing actual dangerous individuals who have the capacity to carry out a plot of any sort.
Well, is there any way to get out of this? I mean, we were wrong-footed from the beginning,
right,
with George W. Bush not only talking about crusades, but even using the word jihad, mm-hmm, which is actually a noble term in a spiritual sense. Instead of referring to these people as criminals, it became instead of it being an intelligence and a police operation around the world. And after all, it did happen, 9/11, in the very city where the United Nations is. The world's sympathy was there for America. So we've gone from being the victim to the victimizer because of this footprint. And I take it what JSOC is about is, you know, a lighter footprint with a bigger hammer.
That's a good way of putting it. And, you know, you're asking about how do we break this cycle. You know, my answer may be something different than you would imagine, because it's not something about military policy or intelligence policy. We live in a country where corporations are entirely in control of our political system and our political process. There's a legalized form of corruption and bribery known as campaign financing, where almost every member of Congress, both houses, is bought and paid for by at least one corporate interest. And so unless we get corporations out of our political process, nothing will ever fundamentally change, because those who go to Washington are there on behalf of corporations, not on behalf of their constituents in most cases. So there's no incentive to actually say, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing these drone bombings. There's far more of an incentive to say, what's the next toy we can give the military to play with, and how does that make jobs in my district, and how does that make money and profit for the corporations that make it possible for me to keep winning these elections? So it's not about we need to just legislate differently, or we need to tweak this law or get these standards in place for when we kill an American or a non-American. Unless we address the root of the issue, which is that corporations have given an incentive to every member of Congress to continue to support these wars, nothing will fundamentally change.
But curiously enough, it's not your father's old military-industrial complex we have. We have a new adjunct to that, and that is this phenomenon of contractors, mm-hmm, which came to light with the Snowden affair with Booz Allen Hamilton,
right,
which in turn is owned by the Carlyle Group, which is the ultimate in the inside of revolving door. So to my mind, you know, what Washington has become, and of course you covered this in your book about U.S. mercenaries with Blackwater, but also Halliburton,
yeah,
is, you know, that we have a system. And curiously enough, Obama's signature healthcare was a victim to the same contracting scam, where you can just hang up a shingle, hire the cheapest possible people, and then you mark up their salary tenfold to the taxpayer.
Yeah.
It is – somebody described it to me as Washington has become Nigeria on the Potomac.
that's not – and having been to Nigeria and Washington, D.C., I actually don't think it's that far from reality. We have a radically outsourced bureaucracy in this country. The entire country is run by corporations. And when it comes to intelligence and military operations, what has happened since World War II is everything that Eisenhower warned against when he talked about the rise of a military-industrial complex. And he was only envisioning a world that had tanks and fighter bombers, not actually hiring of mercenaries to fight wars on behalf of rich nations around the world, even if their home country has no stake in them. So in a case like the Snowden story, what's fascinating about that is, you know, someone like Snowden takes the documents and says he wants to blow the whistle on the system and about constitutional abuses and waste, fraud, potentially crimes being committed by the CIA, the NSA, others. What if someone with his same clearances decides that they want to take sensitive information, intelligence, information about American citizens, and sell it to another government or give it to the highest bidder from another corporation? We're sitting on a ticking time bomb with how radically privatized the national security bureaucracy is.
And I believe, Jeremy Scahill, that that is subtext for the anger that the Germans have, that the NSA, because it's privatized so much of its activities to these for-profit corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, their focus is not necessarily on national security but on economic espionage. And apparently you know, Merkel's not that upset that we know what she has on her sandwiches,
right.
but she's really upset about the NSA finding out what Germany's trade position will be on these on this new trade compact that they're designing.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, there has been a rise in the number of and scope of the operations of private intelligence companies. You know, in some ways, the biggest scandal here is not necessarily the NSA spying on Americans or, you know, scooping up our data. In many ways, it is the corporations that are doing that with no regulation and no oversight whatsoever. And they could be working for foreign governments. They could be working for other corporations. They can be doing dirty tricks and surveillance on activists. And the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, are systematic abusers of the privacy rights of Americans and non-Americans alike. And yet all we're focused on right now is the NSA. But there's a whole huge system that includes corporations and numerous federal so-called law enforcement agencies as well.
So let's return to your film, Jeremy Scahill. It's up for the Academy Awards, Dirty Wars. And JSOC, of course, came back into the news to some extent in a peculiar way when the biographer of General Petraeus sent a nasty note to a Lebanese-American woman down in near JSOC's headquarters.
Near Tampa,
Who apparently was wining and dining all of these generals, all of these top secret warriors. And we don't even know whether it was what the KGB used to call a honey trap, the idea that after these lavish Lebanese meals, there wasn't some pillow talk involved. And I've never, to the life of me, ever figured out what was at the bottom of that. Why did this girlfriend of Petraeus—
Paula Broadwell.
Why did she send that note?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, have you ever gotten to the—I mean, I know this is like a tabloid version of what you've been covering, but it indicates to me a kind of— arrogance and recklessness that's beyond belief.
Well, you know, part of the story that has not gotten much attention is that among the pieces of information that Paula Broadwell extracted from David Petraeus when they were in their relationship while she was, you know, writing his biography and serving as a sort of informal advisor to Petraeus is that in Benghazi, you know, inside of Libya, there was a covert operations program going on with the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command. And that's never been fully investigated. And part of why it hasn't is because of the crazy carnival with the Tea Party and other groups focusing in on Benghazi as sort of the second coming of 9/11. There is a real scandal there that is not being investigated because it's just turned into a carnival of crazy. And the White House is the chief beneficiary of how insane some of these people are on the right because there actually was a scandal there. I believe from sources I've talked to that the U.S. was running a hit campaign inside of Libya using the CIA paramilitary division and JSOC, and that this strike on the U.S. consulate that killed the ambassador, Stevens, was in retaliation to this program that John Brennan, who's now the CIA director, and other senior officials at the White House were running. And so the Petraeus scandal, as it was called, boiled down to the extramarital affair, which it always does. That's the only way you can lose your position in the United States. Is you can screw people all over the world, but if you literally screw someone other than your wife, then you're going to go down, right? I mean, you can screw whole countries over, but don't touch someone who's who you're not married to. And yet, I think there is a real scandal there that should be investigated. Remember, Petraeus was the CIA director at the time that this scandal broke. I would imagine, and I've heard this from people inside of that structure, Petraeus was at odds with someone powerful within the CIA and the U.S. military over something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like this don't just happen by accident.
Sure. I think it's pretty clear that the CIA didn't like him. I mean, if you read one of the most amazing pieces of information, which was buried in the style section of the Washington Post, was the tape that Woodward got hold of Fox News, Roger Ailes, and Rupert Murdoch soliciting Petraeus to run for president through an intermediary. It's breathtaking.
The way that they kneecapped Petraeus' career was incredible. I mean, there's a lot of smoke there, and it'll be fascinating one day to see what details come out. I mean, the right loved Petraeus, and Petraeus was one of the most powerful figures in modern American military history. And I do think that there were very powerful forces within the right that wanted him to run for president. And I think he probably would have had he not been taken out in this manner. I mean, now he's lecturing at CUNY in New York and Yale and what have you.
It's like, well, when you hear this tape, you realize if you're Obama, and presumably Obama heard the tape, maybe even ordered it. But the long and the short of it is you had to keep this guy in the tent. I mean, so it looks like they dumped him on the CIA. The CIA weren't too happy about it. And they found a way.
Well, there's a war between the CIA and the U.S. military special operations forces that has raged in some form or another for 50 plus years. But it really intensified and came to a head when Rumsfeld was the defense secretary in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. You had the disaster at Tora Bora. Rumsfeld did not like the fact that the CIA could acquire members of the SEALs or Delta Force to put them on CIA missions. So he stopped cooperating with the CIA. And so what we've seen happen is that the U.S. Military forces under the auspices of the Special Operations Command have started to do more spying and get into the realm of the CIA. The CIA has gone back to its paramilitary roots and has radically escalated its involvement in overt paramilitary type operations. So you have these two entities struggling to maintain their domain but also become more like the other. And there's a real war between the two of them. So Petraeus coming in as a military man to the CIA at that moment in time was probably perceived by those in real power at the CIA as a threat.
Well, but curious enough, in terms of what we were talking about earlier, which is this supposed deliberations going on whether or not to zap this American in Pakistan, mm-hmm. is supposedly a result of these new guidelines that Obama approved last year, which was to move much of this activity away from the CIA to the DOD or to the JSOC. But it looks like with Brennan in there,
it's a smoke and mirrors.
Exactly.
I mean, look. I mean, I people that I know within the intelligence community sort of laugh that anyone even gives any credence to this story. I mean, first of all, the military can do covert operations and has been doing them throughout its history. You know, under Title 50 of the U.S. Code, that is intelligence operations. Title 10 is military operations. The military doesn't need to work with the CIA to do a Title 50 operation, and that's a common misperception, and it gets repeated endlessly by supposedly well-informed journalists. This is a shell game meant to sort of trick or hoodwink the American people into believing that Obama has found a more effective, responsible way to assassinate people around the world. It doesn't matter if it's the CIA or the military doing it. Neither is an accountable institution.
But in terms of the budgets, there's no question that the DOD has almost unlimited resources. Now,
completely
of course,
unlimited, yes.
They've been pouring money also, as we know, into intelligence as well. So in terms of oversight, who has the greater slush fund here and who is the least accountable? Because my understanding is that basically there's no accounting with JSOC. They just show up with bags full of money, buy people. If they don't buy them, they kill them, you know.
Right. I mean, there's money laundering that goes on by both the CIA and certain elements of the U.S. military. I mean, there are slush funds around the world. In some cases, you have construction equipment that is sent over from the United States to Central Asian nations. And then the construction equipment is used for legitimate construction projects, but then it's sold to Chinese corporations and the Chinese pay in cash for it. And now you've developed a huge slush fund that can be used for operations in Uzbekistan and Pakistan and elsewhere. This happens all the time from both of those entities. Congress doesn't want to go anywhere near that. So what happens, it's not that there on paper there isn't a structure to oversee JSOC by the Congress or the CIA. It's that no one on Capitol Hill wants to ask questions to which the answer would make them have to do something or take a moral stand. So it's not that the heads of these entities don't appear before Congress, usually in closed session. It's that no one on Capitol Hill is going to ask them a question that's going to require them to take a moral stand against a military operation.
So, Jeremy Scahill, how do we then navigate between this constant killing by night that's going on with JSOC operating in, 50-plus countries or something?
Special Operations Command says now that there's over 100 countries where the U.S. has some form of an operation with special operations forces.
And as you show in your film, Dirty Wars, where we'll work with warlords, you name it, like the Somali warlord that you profiled.
You know what you're going to see come out soon, and there's been trickles of it that have come out in the press. The extent of U.S. Involvement in Mexico and other Central American countries under the guise of the so-called war on drugs is far greater than we've been led to believe. And the U.S. is using so-called war on terror type tactics increasingly in Central and Latin America. And of course, the war on drugs is a totally fraudulent entity. What it really is about is counterinsurgency. You're going to see stories come out in the coming months. Some will be published by us that are going to reveal details about the extent to which special operations forces are operating in our own hemisphere under the guise of the war on drugs.
But the broader question I have, though, is that since the end of the Cold War, when national threats went away and subnational and transnational threats took over, And of course, you know, we're obviously like, you know, a giant super tanker. We're slowly turning much of our defense budget is oriented towards Cold War toys, et cetera. But this, obviously, the change has been this growth of special operations. And with all of this lethality, we still seem to have this problem where if you look at all of the wars that the U.S. has been involved with since the end of the Cold War, starting with Panama, which was the first one, what we've done is we have sent the military down to essentially get rid of one guy. You know, whether it's Noriega, whether it's Saddam Hussein twice, whether it's Milosevic, you name it. So we beat the hell out of these countries. We sanction them, we starve them, and then we bomb them just to get one guy. Mm-hmm. So with all of this secret lethality, why is it that we have to go to these big wars as opposed to employ the JSOC people? I'm not suggesting
I understand
a policy of assassination, but I can't understand that paradox.
Right. Well, I don't think corporations wouldn't make as much money if
so
that was the policy.
You need the war.
War is the health of the state. I mean, it's the I really do think, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. I think it's just the way that the system is set up. When the NATO air war happened in Libya, when they were trying to, and then they successfully did, overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Gaddafi wasn't brought down by a popular revolution against him. There was a popular revolt against him in some parts of the country, but that's not what brought him down. What brought him down was the fact that the U.S. and its NATO allies bombed the living hell out of that country and completely incapacitated Gaddafi's ability to fight back against a foreign, you know, incursion into the country. That was a huge profit moment for big war corporations. Each cruise missile costs $2.3 million, you know, that's fired. And the U.S. just rains those missiles down. We spend an incredible amount of money developing these drones. Each Navy SEAL, we spend millions of dollars to train these individuals. If you just send them in for a surgical operation, the war corporations aren't going to make the money. They're not going to get to use their toys. So I do think a part of U.S. strategic thinking always relies on the idea that we have to use the most modern toys that we have, toys of war, in every operation. But it is an asymmetric war now. And people within the special operations community know this. The U.S. has started to adopt tactics that mirror al-Qaeda's tactics, you know, on the ground. Who's killing the Iranian scientists right now, the Iranian nuclear scientists? The video was just leaked the other day of this snatch operation that the U.S. did in Libya, where they took this guy who was suspected of being involved with the 98 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. You know, the U.S. is involved to this day in kidnapping, in bumping people off, and in putting people in gulags in other nations, and all under the tenure of a Nobel Peace Prize winning Democratic president who is a constitutional lawyer by training.
And in your film, Dirty Wars, of course, the victims of some of these night raids, the ordinary Afghan citizens in, bewildered and in shock, having had their families and women and children murdered in front of them, talk about these bearded Americans, and they refer to them as the American Taliban.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I mean, I look like the guys who killed their loved ones in many ways. You know, I'm a 6 foot tall white guy with a beard, and I show up in their village. I mean, they could have easily hacked me to death, but they didn't. They chose to tell their story. And you know, what was chilling for me in the journey of making this film and going to Yemen and Somalia and Afghanistan and elsewhere is that in different languages, in different countries around the world, we heard the same thing over and over again, that people said, when my loved one was killed or when the bomb hit our village, I wanted to put a suicide vest on and blow myself up among the Americans. It became so real to me and tangible how we are creating new enemies. We're not creating new terrorists. We're creating new enemies, people who actually have a legitimate score to settle against us. And 10, 20 years from now, I think we'll see the impact of what we've done now. It may not happen in the next year or 5 years, but we are going to pay a price for this.
Well, to my mind, that is what in many ways the message for your movie, the Dirty Wars, is that, you know, Bush tried to make the Iraq war as sanitary as possible. The press didn't show dead Americans or dead Iraqis. Mm-hmm. It was all a rah-rah cheer squad largely that led us into that quick victory followed by the slow defeat. And you know, the fact that only our military and the military families bear the burden. I just spoke yesterday with a young woman who I had interviewed earlier during the Iraq war, whose husband was hit by an IED, fellow soldier, and about the painful marriage that they went through just because of this PTSD and the extraordinary trauma. and you realize that they bore the burden is largely on those that are sent off on these misadventures. But Dirty Wars tells you and shows you that this is all on us. Mm. This is where we're heading. You know that we no longer have the luxury of having this tool that is distant from us. You know, because it is as you point out, it's creating enemies. You know.
Right. And I mean, I think you're making – it's an excellent point, too, about military families in this country because for the most part, they're the only ones that have to think about any of these issues on any given day. But if we don't start to sort of look at the humanity of the other in the course of now 12, 13 years of this so-called war on terror, we ignore it at our own peril. We're sort of whistling past the graveyard. You know, anyone who thinks that 9/11 was, you know, because people hated McDonald's and freedom, you know, didn't understand the history of that, of the organization of Al-Qaeda, but also wasn't paying attention to U.S. and Israeli policy. We are making those same mistakes again. The forces we're backing right now inside of Syria, the forces that we've unleashed in Iraq through the invasion and occupation, the situation inside of Libya, what we're doing throughout the Horn of Africa, on the Arabian Peninsula. We are creating the very threat that we claim to be fighting with these policies. The greatest threat to our national security on a military level is our own national security policy. And that's pretty sobering to see in the flesh around the world.
Well, that was in fact the point I was trying to make is that we own this. You know, it may be distant from us, and they may have tried to make it distant with these shadowy special warriors operating at night. But we're the ones that are going to endure the blowback. Well, Jeremy Scahill, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Keep up your great work.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rosschert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.